Hello and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, your host, and I'm joined today with my esteemed panel of colleagues, Mr. Gabriel Krauser.
How's it, Nick?
And Mr. Herman Pretorius.
Nick.
Right, so let's go right into it with a little thing that Ramaphosa said in Parliament. So Ramaphosa was speaking about denying that apartheid was a crime against humanity. And the wording is not entirely exact here, but basically he said that it rose to the level of being treasonous when you denied that apartheid was a crime against humanity because it cut against the core of the non-racial ethos and values of the nation. Gabriel, should it be treasonous? Should we think of it as treasonous?
No, I think the short answer is no. This is about words. This is easy to write off as just semantics, but words are sort of a huge They're how we communicate, and how we communicate is how we weave the fabric of society together and sustain it. So to go back, if W. de Klerk never denied that apartheid was terrible, wicked, awful, evil, and stupid, he said that it was. He also did more than talk the talk. He walked the walk. He dismantled apartheid. He has as much claim as anybody in the world to having been at the forefront of undoing that corrupt system. When he said that it's not a crime against humanity, he was saying that the UN's definition of a crime against humanity is misapplied to this case because it also applies to the genocide case. That's one of the arguments, and apartheid is not the same as genocide. The other argument is that the lobby to get the UN to say this was by the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was lobbying to declare apartheid a crime against humanity at the same time that it had literally millions, tens of millions of people in gulags and was being friendly and propping up dictators who were burying their opponents alive underground
in some cases committing genocide.
So there was a hypocritical aspect to that that frustrated de Klerk. Are those arguments good enough? I would say the first argument is not good enough. The UN also declares murder and rape to be a crime against humanity. So there have been at least 500,000 crimes against humanity in South Africa since 1994. I think rather than saying crimes against humanity are this really awful thing, let's preserve the word only for genocide, we can let genocide do the work of the word of genocide and let crime against humanity speak to anything that whether you are within a particular legal system or not is something that shouldn't be done. So murder, rapes are crimes against humanity. Apartheid was a crime against humanity. Expropriation without compensation would be a crime against humanity. And that's the way that we should be thinking about it. But it's a semantic thing. Ramaphosa is making a semantic mistake too in saying that this is treason. And I think because the definition of treason is quite narrow.
Yeah, I'm very hesitant to ever apply that term to something that isn't action that directly undermines the legitimacy of violent way.
Exactly. The violent attempt to overthrow a government, that's treason. Planning to do it, that's treason. Yes. Anything else is not treason.
Leaking to an enemy nation during a war.
Yeah. But so here's a very frustrating thing about so if you cut through the semantics, which are, you know, some people are just going to find talk about words to be esoteric philosophical hogwash. If you cut through that, what's the human story here? The human story is that F.W. de Klerk did a great and important thing in leading the way from the Nat side to dismantling apartheid. He has subsequently been an exemplary sort of emeritus of leadership in this country. He's been quite reserved. He hasn't said a hell of a lot. Where he has come forward, he's generally said really sound and good things. On the 30th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison, a release that was ordered by F.W. de Klerk together with his ordering of the unbanning of the SACP and the ANC, really important progressive steps towards dismantling the system. He's not given a lot of time of day. And in fact, in the next SONA, he's sort of hounded by Julius Malema. Ramaphosa then decides to go after F.W. de Klerk, not in terms of what he was actually saying and not in terms of what he's actually stood for, but sort of taking this very unsympathetic interpretation of his semantic quibble with the UN, basically, and blowing it up to say that, you know, one of the great living heroes, one of the two living Nobel laureates of peace in this country is treasonous. This seems like an opportunistic way to drum up support from the ultra-race nationalists who hate F.W. de Klerk, in particular the EFF. And at the same time that Ramaphosa is calling F.W. de Klerk treasonous, he's calling on Julius Malema and his wife to say, I'm very sorry that another ANC MP declared that he has evidence of domestic abuse in your household. Mm. So I think Ramaphosa is, I think that he is demonstrating, it's just, it seems cynical to me. It's hard to understand this without cynicism. Either he didn't hear what de Klerk actually said, where de Klerk actually literally in the same sentence that he said it's not a crime against humanity, he said, I'm not denying that it was terrible. I'm not denying that it is wicked. And please look at my record. I helped dismantle it. He either didn't hear that, or he did hear it and he doesn't want other people to hear that. Instead, he wants to undermine an important icon in this country, so he's, someone that we can all get behind.
He's either ill-informed or malicious. Herman, what's your take?
Well, I think the absurdity, I think, was captured in the first remarks you made, is that treason has a very narrow definition. And it's interesting, Gabriel and I are currently looking at some positions surrounding EWC, and it's fascinating when people say, this is the position of the ANC president, not of the government. So who says what matters? The fact that in the National Parliament, the President of the Republic called a former president a traitor to his country is meaningful.
Yeah.
It's not just a thing that should be said and, you know, as Gabriel says,
yeah, this is not chilling around a bribe.
No, this is the president of the country
in a speech,
in an official address to Parliament, calling a former president and a former deputy president of this constitutional dispensation treasonous, a traitor to his country.
It's like, is he going to ask the NPA to follow that up with an investigation? Is this going to go to the Equality Court?
Either he should do that and follow through on the weight of his remarks and of his office, or he should be very careful ever saying something like this again and should apologize at the earliest opportunity.
It's,
you cannot have it, oh, it was just a presidential remark. Yeah. Or it, you know, either,
yeah,
either
you can't have it
so,
both.
So my read of the speech was that it was actually very almost an offhand remark that he didn't expect to be taken that seriously.
But his offhand remarks
he baked into the it wasn't an offhand remark in the sense that it wasn't prepared. Mm. It's an offhand remark in the sense that it was right at the end of paragraphs. It was kind of just to sort of punctuate it and say, oh, this is so. He himself was kind of delegitimizing the word and using it cheaply.
Yeah,
that was the intention.
I just want to jump in here is Ramaphosa needs to be more careful with what he damn well says. This is the same president who denied farm murders in this country.
Yeah, he said there are no farm killings.
No farm killings. Not some qualified, it's an overblown issue. He said there's no farm killings. He said the days of load shedding is over, that there would... this president must be more careful with what he says. It
matters. If he does want to point out, you know, treason, I don't know how far it goes. I mean, I think Andile Mkhatama at Black First Land First, they've called for mass legal and illegal land invasions. Their slogan is Black First Land First. They've made comments that more explicitly laid out the sort of either you give us all of your land or we're going to kill all white people, drive you all into
land
the sea.
Or death,
land or death, sorry.
That 5-in-1 ratio thing.
Yeah, yeah. You've got Julius Malema saying we're going to slaughter all whites if we don't get what we want in terms of land. Like, if you are going to use the word treason cheaply, sort of outside of its narrow definition.
And you're the president of the republic.
Those seem like
more appropriate cases, perhaps.
Direct assaults on the fabric of the society. Yes. F.W. de Klerk did not deny that apartheid was bad. He is not an apartheid denialist. He is an apartheid dismantler. And
one exactly. of the few in history.
Yeah.
When you look at what he goes on to say in the speech, that's exactly the point he's saying. He's saying it's treasonous because it undermines the project of non-racial reconciliation.
This man
and that
helped
kind of
launch that
but
project.
As you say, these comments are far more damaging to that, and Ramaphosa never had any desire to say anything similar.
And he can be mature and say, look, guys, and there have been all kinds of apologies coming out of de Klerk's corner for saying, you know, I'm very sorry for the confusing impression that this made. And Ramaphosa could have latched onto that and said, look, a confusing impression was made, but I want to stand in solidarity with the former deputy president of this constitutional dispensation to say that the important message to get from it is that this guy knows that apartheid was, by any name, evil and wicked and stupid, and by his deeds undid it. And it's too easy for the youth and those race rabbit populists who are trying to stoke up fear to villainize this guy. Yeah. But we've got to remember that it wasn't Mandela alone, it wasn't the ANC alone, that that creating this wonderful South African rainbow was a multilateral effort, and it, in order for it to continue, it needs to continue to be a multilateral effort. We need collaboration from people inside and outside of the ANC.
It is a project that belongs to no one group in South Africa.
He could have said that. It's really it's available.
Another facet of this issue is if de Klerk wanted to say it's a crime against humanity, or it's not a crime against humanity, it wasn't evil, it was nice, I ended it because, you know, I was concerned about my pension. Even if de Klerk had said something as absurd as that, you know, apartheid was actually quite good for the blacks, as many on the far right of racial extremism in this country sometimes claim.
Yeah, his opponents, the people that he had to...
The people who call him a traitor.
Who call him a commie. Even if he had said that, that is still not treason. That's the problem with being in favor of free speech, is you end up defending the rascals and the rogues. And
well, if no one wants to ban uncontentious speech,
and the whole case that Gabriel is making about the context of this is absolutely correct. But then even if that case completely was ignored, you still have the basic freedom of speech issue, that it's the right of a citizen of a free constitutional dispensation to say that I don't think the previous dispensation was a crime against humanity. I personally think they're wrong. The legal definition to my mind seems quite clear. But either we have a country with freedom of expression or not.
All right, so let's move away from silly parliamentary semantics to abroad, where we have some interesting tales to tell. So the first is there was a debate in the United States. So the Democratic Party in the United States is looking at choosing its candidate for president to face Donald Trump in November this year. And a late entry to the race has been billionaire Michael Bloomberg. Now, he spent already more on his political campaign than basically any campaign before. I think despite the fact that he's hardly into the campaign, he spent more money than Barack Obama did in 2012. So he's really testing how far money can get you in American politics.
So far.
He had a very tough debate. He's seemed to be rising in a lot of polls recently, so it looks like some of his strategy is paying off. But he was heavily attacked by many of the other candidates on stage in this debate the other night in Nevada. Firstly, Elizabeth Warren attacked him for non-disclosure agreements he signed with employees, particularly female employees, in relation to comments that he made to them.
We can't really know.
But apparently the phrase, you know, horse-faced lesbian played into...
Warren brought that up.
Warren brought it up. He also allegedly told a staffer when hearing that she was pregnant that she should stop messing about and just kill it because he doesn't have time for this. And he said, I believe someone was saying that there's about 40 employees who have tried to sue him at some point. So he's clearly not everyone's favorite boss. Herman, do you think he has a shot at the Democratic nomination? He's currently running behind Bernie Sanders, but some people think that he might have.
I think he does. I think he does. The reason being that it's not clear what the Clintonesque establishment, which I think still controls a large part of the Democratic Party's mechanisms and functions in several states, it's not clear whether they would be willing to give Bernie Sanders a fair go. I'm not going to say that they're going to necessarily rig results, as the conspiracy theories coming out of Iowa were, but I definitely think that...
They might put their thumb on the scales a bit.
A bit. And exactly as they did last time to Bernie Sanders. Mm. And so I think it's a genuine shot, because at this point, five or six candidates for the Democratic nomination are all of them rather underwhelming. There's no clear front runner. Usually at this point in the race, you have some direction of, you know, where's it going? Who's the challenger? Who's the main challenger? Who's the American
conservative writer John Podoretz has said that he thinks that this race is a lot like the Republican internal conflict in 2012, where Mitt Romney continued as a weak front runner, but still the front runner, and ultimately went on to win. He suspects that Bernie Sanders might win in a similar way. Gabriel, do you think Bloomberg has a shot at the nomination?
Yeah, I think it's less than half. But I think he does have a credible chance. One of the things to note is that everyone at the last debate turned on him aggressively. And
which is odd because he's not in first place.
No. And that's a good,
good for him.
That, so I think it is paradoxically, and to some potential voters, that is going to be good for him. It gives him a lot of time. It means he's being talked about a lot. And it means he gets talked about a lot by incredible media pundits on America's mainstream left. Mm. Who
incredible as in not credible.
Correct. So, and I think a lot of people's response is when they say this is bad, they're like, well, the media's try to fool us so many times. If you're saying it's bad, then it must be good. And that that's a lot of what helped Trump. Trump kept getting insulted by...
There's a very good example of exactly that happening now. So his social media has been very good.
Yeah, he's really
literally the best money can buy.
Yeah.
And he, to try and find a good moment in his debate, his campaign team put out this very obviously humorous video where he asks, have any of you ever started a business?
Yeah.
And then it plays the sound of a chirping cricket while close-ups of the other candidates on the debate stage looking uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But a huge wave of journalists have attacked it as being fake news and misinformation.
Yeah, which reinforces the meme. Like, people aren't that stupid. I think one of the things that a lot of mainstream media, particularly in America, and us kind of, it's like they caught the cold and we really got the full-on flu, is they think that you can bully people into believing what you say, regardless of what you're saying. And I think a lot of people hate watch CNN. A lot of people hate read the New York Times. They read it in precisely this way. They're like, I don't believe what you're saying. Also because I have the internet and I have TV. I can watch the debate myself. I can see whether you're telling the truth or not. And it's clear that you're not. And it's clear that often you haven't. So one thing that Bloomberg
they seem to think that most of America sort of confused grandmothers who are reading Facebook and
everything. Like, who really just get spoon-fed information.
Donald Trump really gave a Medal of Honor to a dog.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. That was a meme that was posted out, and then they were like, oh, fake news.
That's fake news. It's a doctor.
It's just a joke. Okay, so one thing that's in Bloomberg's favor is everyone bullying him could paradoxically boost him. Another thing in his favor is that he is a credibly self-made billionaire who's added a hell of a lot of value, who's connected with Bloomberg News, which is generally, I mean, it's got some scripts and people are trying to point out a sympathetic treatment of China. But overall, I think a very, very credible institution.
I was looking up what he actually became wealthy from last night, and it was his creation of what they call the Bloomberg Terminal, which is a way of distributing financial information. It's like a program to do that.
And so the third thing that's really good for him is that my sense is that there is a shape to this Democratic primary, and that you have the sort of ultra-left socialists whose spending ideas are just about spending trillions and trillions to make all the problems go away of other people's money. So that's Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. The difference between them is Warren tries to play up social identity politics, whereas Sanders sticks to class much more consistently.
Yeah, it's very much a personality difference.
Yeah. Yeah, in the center, you've got Klobuchar, you've got Pete Buttigieg, and you've got Mike Bloomberg. And I think all of them are credibly more centrist. I think that there are significant differences between them. And then the personality qualities kind of shine out. Klobuchar is a bit more aggro as a politician. Mayor Pete's got this very low-level kind of
McKinsey, like the consultant. He feels like a consultant.
Well, a lot of ways. Yeah, I mean, but he's also got this fabulous history where he's been a soldier and a Rhodes Scholar, and I think he's got the best history of really reaching across the aisle and reaching out to...
Interestingly, there was a very terse moment in the debate between him and Amy Klobuchar where he answers a question in Spanish, and Amy Klobuchar, clearly losing her temper a little bit, says, "We can't be all as perfect as you, Pete."
Yeah. Yeah, so he is really easy to hate in that kind of way. And then Mike Bloomberg is easy to hate in the more obvious way of being a bit of an, what's the polite word? Ordinary man.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it.
And so I think that the biggest challenge is going to be going forward for the next couple of primary elections to see who's willing to step down in order for one of those two pockets to sort of consolidate the vote. Obviously, there's Joe Biden. I haven't mentioned him.
Well, everyone else seems to be forgetting to mention him as well.
Yeah. So
on the debate stage, he would kind of occasionally go and say, "But I've done all this. Yeah. I'm the best.
I'm Barack Obama."
And then everyone would go back to ignoring him.
So the question is, so if Klobuchar were to step down and say, "Okay, Mayor Pete and I have our differences, but I really think you should go for him," and Joe Biden were to step down and say, "Mayor Pete and I have had our differences, but he's a younger man. I'm getting too old. Give your vote to him." Then I think Pete Buttigieg would be ahead of both Bloomberg and of Sanders, potentially. He could start with eating away at that. And then Bloomberg would start seeming like a spoiler. Then he might have to drop out. And then Mayor Pete's got his chance. But that's only if Sanders and Warren continue to split the ultra left. And Warren doesn't look like she's going anywhere. Voluntarily, she is sinking in the polls, but between her and Sanders, there's this battle to try and consolidate that ultra-left vote. Mm. And from there, so everyone wants to control their own pocket and then take command of the party. And I think that it's going to be the side that coordinates that best that's going to win. Mm. And if they don't coordinate, then Sanders alone will most likely Mitt Romney his way through to this and end up dragging the Democrats into a situation where they are asking voters to choose between Trump and a communist.
So Herman, I just want to push back on that idea that you posed at the beginning, that the sort of Democratic establishment, as it's often sort of vaguely called, will step in to block Sanders from coming in and aid someone like Bloomberg. So I think there's a number of problems with that. One of them is that the Democratic establishment, as much as it exists anymore, has not agreed on who to back. It can't. It itself is divided between whether to back Buttigieg or Biden or Bloomberg.
Mm.
So that's the one problem. And the second problem is that so far there's been very little evidence that they're actually made serious moves. Senator Harry Reid, who's generally considered to be part of the establishment, has very close links with the Culinary Union in Nevada, who traditionally have extreme amounts of power in the Democratic caucuses there.
The key to the Democratic Party is through its stomach.
Yes. And he did not put pressure on them to endorse any one candidate. Yes. So even though they had some mild criticisms of Bernie Sanders, ultimately the Culinary Union did not endorse any candidate in Nevada, leaving the way open for Sanders to take it.
I think that's exactly why I say this is more of a in some states issue. This will be in states that have been Clinton-esque Democrats since the mid-90s, where the party establishment is of a specific orientation on a lower level than it's people like Harry Reid who represent on a more, national level. So I think that'll be in a few states, but I don't think it'll be as concerted, as establishmentarianist as in 2016, when I think there was an obvious attempt
to there was deliberate
punt Clinton,
which forced the resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was the head of the Democratic National Party.
Yes, but I must say that my question is, the Democratic Party must decide how it wants to win this election in November. Will they win it by putting up the anti-Trump? Will they win it by putting up their own Trump? Will they win it on social war, cultural war issues? Will they win it economically? You know, they still have to decide what's the best point of attack for them as a party.
And in a lot of ways, Bloomberg and Sanders are the exact poles of those two things.
The two big options.
So Sanders' theory of the election is that you just motivate left-wing voters to come out in massive numbers.
And bring out the base. A lot of people who didn't vote before. Yeah. And they
swamped the election.
And I must say, I think there is a good argument there. I was reading a piece in the New Yorker, sort of long-form human interest piece about organizers in Milwaukee. Milwaukee's in Wisconsin, really important battleground state, could very well tip the difference in the national election. And a lot of sort of working class and unemployed black people didn't show up to the last election to vote for Clinton, who did show up for Barack Obama. And efforts have been consistently made by a group called Black Leaders American Congress or something, to sort of literally every day, there's at least like a dozen people on the ground hitting the streets, knocking door to door to try and whip those voters. And I think that those voters, from the New Yorker's way of presenting them and the kinds of conversations that were being had, would be more eager to stand up for a guy like Bernie Sanders than they would for a guy like Mayor Bloomberg. If they saw a guy like Mayor Bloomberg, a former Republican, Democrat, Republican switcheroony guy who supported stop and frisk, the kinds of issues that are just sort of demonized and stigmatized, regardless of their real effects, it might dampen their enthusiasm.
There's actually quite a lot of...
Whereas saunas could harness it.
Complexity there. So Mayor Bloomberg is often attacked as being toxic to black voters in the US because he's supported very aggressive measures against crime. And while there is definitely a very large section of the black community in America that's very wary of the police and hostile to them, there's also a section that... thinks that violent crime is the most important issue facing their lives.
Destroying their communities.
He's been outperforming Pete Buttigieg, for example.
We have this paradoxical thing where half of black America seems to be very, very against stop and frisk, and the other half is extremely pro.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, this is one of the problems with breaking people down into racial groups.
But exactly.
The greatest advantage of incumbency is that your coalition going into the election is more established. Because essentially, with the Democratic Party having moved considerably more left than the Republican Party has moved in any direction, really, ideologically, I think to assemble a coalition to win in November is difficult to start with, but is complicated by the fact that I think the Trump coalition, Trump has been really clever in sustaining the unity of his coalition that unexpectedly propelled him to the White House. So the fact that Trump's coalition, his target voters, already very clear at this stage, stable, knows these people, what they need. And the fact that the Democratic Party still needs to do coalition building to identify how they can kick Trump out of the White House.
And it really looks like it's working. So a lot of analysts have predicted that the state to watch in this election is going to be Wisconsin, as he talks about there. And at the moment, the most recent poll of Wisconsin shows Trump up by 7 points.
I didn't see that.
Which is quite a lead. Anyway, we will have to see how that develops. American elections are always very exciting to watch.
Yeah.
So we will keep you updated. Now for our last item, Greece wants its marbles back.
Yes, they've lost their marbles. They lost their marbles in the early 19th century. It's the Elgin marbles. Lord Elgin claims, a British aristocrat, the claim from the British is that Lord Elgin bought these sculptures that were on the Parthenon hill in Athens legally from the Ottoman government or the Ottoman authorities at the time. And then they were taken between, I think, like 1840 and 1812, taken to the UK and have been on display in the British Museum since 1817. But now, with Brexit just being the constant source of, you know, twists and turns in politics, this is probably the weirdest twist and turn of the whole thing, is that Greece is now, with the support of Italy, inserted into the draft mandate for the EU negotiating team, that cultural artifacts and historical things like that need to be protected and repatriated. And Italy and Greece say, oh, no, this is just to prevent the illegal trading of cultural artifacts. You know, that huge black market across Europe. I mean, they just can't help themselves.
It's pretty big.
It's bigger than Egypt and things like that, where it's actually, a significant chunk of the informal economy. But analysts across the board consider that this is quite a weird shot across the bow deliberately about the Elgin marbles, trying to, I think, touch the UK on their studio.
Yeah. I think it's well designed to play up to the gallery in the UK itself. It's a university circuit, particularly led by SOAS, the former sort of attempt by the UK to build a university for the colonies, for people of the colonies to come in and learn. There's been a lot of push on the left to say that you need to give all this stuff back. This is loot and plunder. I think there's an important counter. And so that's the side that's super disappointed by Brexit and that is looking for grievance. And so Europe is giving them grievance. I think it's good to note, my thinking on this was informed quite substantially by, I think, the world's leading philosopher of race, Kwame Anthony Appiah, who wrote a book called Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers, in which he spends quite a substantial portion of it sort of dwelling on cultural artifacts that aren't in the country of their origins, of their production. And the case that he makes, I mean, I can't get into all of it because the interesting thing about those artifacts is that they find themselves at the intersection of so much that matters politically and that divides political discourse at the moment. But one of the things to note is that the worst thing that can happen in a way, let's say the worst thing that can happen with a cultural artifact of great significance is that it's destroyed.
Yes.
The second worst thing that happens is that it's plundered and then kept in private and then traded around in a black market. So that
only the super rich can enjoy it.
Only the super rich can enjoy it, and it's denied access to academics who place it in a larger context and also figure out from it things that inform the larger context.
The culture and society comes as well.
And so the best thing that you can have really is for it to be preserved and for it to be viewed by lumpen proletarians like us, who hardly know much from much else, but learn a little bit from these awesome experiences. And I can remember seeing the Elden Margles both in the UK, and I can remember going to the Acropolis in Athens. And there's a hell of a lot that was left on top of the Acropolis. The Parthenon is complete. I think it's the Nike tribute that's on the Acropolis where the marbles that were taken are from. There's a whole museum that's been established just under the Acropolis, facing up to it, of various artifacts that were displaced. Here's an interesting thing about that museum. It's very new. Until very recently, Greece didn't have the money to be able to protect its stuff.
The EU built it, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. So for countries, so Appiah makes the case, firstly, that from a pragmatic point of view, for rich countries to hold on to these things and protect them is really has one advantage, which is that they have great tourist facilities and attractions already. There are already a lot of people coming through, so they've got good access. They also have good access for the people that live around those hubs. And they've got the money to preserve them, which is it's quite expensive, both preserving them chemically and in terms of security from other people. And then the other thing is the slightly – and look, just by the way, like if you go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York – they've got a statue. They've got like a small pyramid inside there, and a whole bunch of tombs from Egypt. You know why? Because they gave Egypt like billions of dollars to try and help them stop the pyramids from being looted. They've been looted for the last 10,000 years. Sand dunes go away. Dudes go in, take the stuff. So like, we're going to help you with this, that, and that. Some infrastructure projects, whatever. And in exchange, amongst other things, what we'd like is a small bit of a pyramid. And it's a beautiful thing to behold. And they paid for it to come over. They protected. There it sits by the Whistlers, by the Picassos, by the Durers. It's a really multicultural experience. And this is, I think, the key of Appiah's point. The Elgin marbles today don't belong to Egypt. It's very hard to see how they're to Greece. It is a civilizational achievement.
Yes.
The civilization of the universal, I think, is a phrase that he uses, is a very important thing for liberals to defend. Cosmopolitanism is a very important thing for liberals to defend. We are all citizens of the world. You can be a citizen of the world and a citizen of a country and be a patriot too, as Appiah's father was. He nearly died for Ghana and Nkrumah's right-hand man at the same time as a cosmopolitan. It's his anecdote. We can all have our own. But the important point is that Isaac Newton discovered mathematical equations that describe the fabric of the universe better than anyone else had done before and better than anyone else has done since when it comes to the kind of education level that most people get in terms of physics. Isaac Newton's theory of gravity is not the ownership. It's not the intellectual property
of the UK.
It is a universal bit of IP, if you think of it as property at all. It's something that we can all tap into and that informs the building of this table and the roads from China to Vietnam and from Chile to Argentina. Likewise, the Elgin marbles tell us something about humanity itself. They come from 2,000 years ago. To connect ancient Greece to the modern state of Greece,
it's a very different place.
Yes.
Is I think, literally irresponsible. And I think that the only way to really make the case that modern Greece owns the Elgin marbles, given the particular teleology of its transfer, etiology of its transfer, is to basically make the race nationalist claim. that people of Greek blood have a particular connection to Greek artifacts and therefore should have the closest access to them. And it's exactly that blood value that I think liberals need to check against, whether it's about property rights fundamentally, whether it's about cultural artifacts and whether I as a South African can connect as closely to an Egyptian or Greek statue or a Japanese haiku as you or the next guy or the next woman. And so I think this really does matter, and I think it's pernicious and cynical of the Greeks to try and play up the divisions in the UK.
Come on.
One thing that I just I agree with everything you said.
Thank you.
But one thing that I just wanted to a less philosophical level is, where do you draw the line? I mean, are the Welsh going to ask for Stonehenge's rocks back? You know, when does a piece of history become a piece of history? Will Cairo ask for the Parisian obelisk back? Where do you draw the line, saying?
The Statue of Liberty. France should just say, look, by the way, we gave this to you at a time when our government was a bit corrupt. It really belongs to us. We built it. We sent it to you. Can we have it back?
So actually, the fact...
It might be an American icon, but who cares?
But I think the Elgin Marbles...
Our blood.
...have been in the British Museum for 200 years. It
well protected and with great access. It's not hard to get into the British Museum. It's one of the cheapest, most accessible...
And part of London culture. So the question then becomes, you know, how far back do you take the idea of theft? Because then... Every single thing, every idea, every concept, every building block, every piece of art will at some point then go back to the point where it, to the place where it was created but irrelevant, instead of the place where it was accepted as culturally.
Well, it wasn't necessarily irrelevant. Well, it's just that the ability of people to protect their stuff fell apart.
I think the winning move here for the UK is going to be they'll say, okay, we'll give you back the Elgin Marbles, but we're going to reignite our claim to the French throne.
Or just you can have this half and you can have this half. Where's the hammers?
So I think we'll close it there. But thank you very much for watching. If you like the show, please like our video. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. And
support the UK's attempt to take back the French throne. No, don't
do that.
Don't support that.
We at the IRR, we play the long game.
Yeah, not a very liberal
Henry
thing.
Henry III, we've got you, man.
So if you like the work that the Institute of Race Relations does and you want to support us.
And Henry III.
Please SMS your name to 32823.
Or SMS Henry to
32823.
Those. The numbers 32823, by the way, come from India.
We'll probably have to give them back soon.
Yeah. There's a fun fact.
If you like fun facts about liberalism and want the show to really end quickly, SMS stop now to 32823.
SMS has cost 1 rand. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you so much for watching and have a wonderful weekend.